Hi, Tony. My name is Robert Green. I am a 78-year-old retired Royal Navy commander living in Christchurch, New Zealand. And I emigrated out here in 1999 after we got married. And I spent 20 years in the British Navy from 1962 to 1982. And then I gradually came out against nuclear power and then finally nuclear weapons. Over the next 20 years or so. In the process, I teamed up basically with Kate, my wife, and she'll introduce herself now.
Hi, Tony. I've been in the peace movement for 40 odd years, not just as a lecturer at university. I have a PhD in peace studies, but I've also, with Rob, helped take a case to the International Court of Justice to try and get nuclear weapons declared illegal. That's what my PhD is on. But I've also been an advisor to our government and to the UN Secretary General on both disarmament education and all disarmament matters, in fact. So we run a little local peace group here, the Disarmament and Security Centre that Rob and I have both been running for a long time, and we've got a good website with a lot of educational material, but also help get New Zealand nuclear free and protest against visits of both American and British nuclear powered and potentially armed warships into New Zealand. So
Well, I know New Zealand is famous around the world for being totally against nuclear power, nuclear weapons. And in fact, they refuse to allow warships to dock, even friendly warships, if they will not say whether or not they've got nuclear weapons on them. So I imagine, Rob, if you can just say something about you have emigrated from the United Kingdom to New Zealand. Is that why?
Well, yes. And it all began really in 1992 when Kate and I met in where was it, Switzerland. I had just been elected chair of the British affiliate of her campaign, which was challenging the legality of nuclear weapons at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. And it was called the World Court Project. And I became the British chair of her campaign. And we were on the International Steering Committee together. And so that's how we got to know each other and became an item. And basically, it grew from there. We a successful campaign in 1996. We got a decision from the World Court. And then we followed through. Basically, in 1999, my father died. I had no need to stay in UK, and so I took the decision to up and come down here into this nuclear-free Garden of Eden.
Well,
But
yes, I mean,
I'd like to add, Tony, that we actually brought Rob out to New Zealand after I met him in '92 to help save our nuclear-free policy, because the Conservative government was trying to overturn the law. And he had information about safety issues with British nuclear submarines. So he travelled right round our country and got to know not just me, but the peace movement here. So he had quite a role in helping us keep our nuclear-free policy at that time.
Well, you're not the only person to see New Zealand as a sort of safe haven from a mad nuclear world. I know that the PayPal founder, Peter Thiel, the transhumanist, he's also bought somewhere in New Zealand so that if he and his colleagues start a nuclear war, he's got a bit of a bolt hole. But I think we should start by just talking a little bit about Hilda Morell. I've got a copy of your book here, Rob, which is about Hilda. She was in the 1980s a well, just a sort of citizen campaigner, somebody that decided, well, I don't think this is safe, I'm going to look into it. And she got involved in the Sizewell B inquiry. And whilst that was all in progress, she was found dead, found murdered. So this is a horrific news story in Britain, obviously, and a horrific experience for your family. Can you say something about, how you came to write that and a bit about Hilda, please?
Right. Well, I think the first thing I ought to actually mention is that since that New Zealand edition, we managed to get a British publisher to publish a UK edition. in 2013 called A Thorn in Their Side. It has an extra chapter in it, which covers what happened after we published the New Zealand version in 2011 and came and launched it in 2012. And one of the great members of our support team in all this have been Michael Mansfield QC, who's on, maybe I should call him Casey now. He is a well-known defense lawyer, involved with the Birmingham Six, and then finishing in the Princess Diana investigation. And basically he agreed to write the foreword to the book. And so I feel a real sense of support and strength from UK in that. And this enabled me basically to get the word out to the world. And one of the issues I'd like to discuss, by the way, is the current campaign to try to stop the Hinkley Point C in nuclear reactor from being built in Somerset.
Well, I mean, it is being built. It's in the middle of being built. But anyway, just on Hilda, it's 40 years since her murder. Can you say why you think it's still an important case? And why, you know, because this book has come out a long time after her murder, hasn't it? And, you know, your aunt's murder.
Yes. Well, of course, it took us a long time to actually accumulate enough information to be able to write a book that actually held together. There were several other books written. It's quite an industry, in fact. But basically, it all began to ramp up when a 16-year-old truant from a foster home back in 1984, about 20 years later, was suddenly arrested in during a cold case review by the West Mercia Police into my aunt's murder. His name was Andrew George. He was in his 30s by then. Anyway, he was charged with her murder. They'd taken that long to find someone and put on trial in Stafford. In 2005, we attended the whole trial, and then he was convicted. He appealed in 2006 in the internet, in the sorry, the court, courts of justice in London, and that was thrown out. And he has been in jail ever since for over 17 years now, refused parole several times. And what we discovered was, in fact, didn't take very much effort to start with to realize that a 16-year-old truant from a foster home who couldn't drive a car couldn't possibly have abducted, let alone murdered, my beloved aunt.
Well, this is, sounds to me like possibly another great miscarriage of justice, but the, one of the greatest miscarriages, a bit like things like Hillsborough, the Hillsborough disaster, is that the British justice system really doesn't seem to work properly. It's horrifying that it should take 40 years for basic evidence, you know, to come out for you to be able to put together in a book form. Anyway, can you tell us what you did in the UK, you know, before you became a anti-nuclear campaigner? Because you were talking about being in the Royal Navy. You know, they also do have nuclear submarines, don't they? I imagine, you know, the Navy would have raised a few eyebrows at somebody like you who was thinking that maybe this wasn't an appropriate way to power a submarine.
Well, of course, nuclear submarines are like underwater sports cars. They are the ultimate in submarine design. And there's no doubt that the submarine service are the special forces of the British Navy. They're very good. And they had a lot of fun going up into Russian waters, Soviet waters, back in the Cold War. And they're back at it again now. But anyway, now what? If I can go back to my own career, I suppose the real relevance of mentioning this is that I found myself backseat aircrew in nuclear strike jets in the 1960s. That's when I specialized in aviation. I had a target in Russia. Then I switched to anti-submarine helicopters who were equipped with nuclear depth charges. And this was in the 1970s. and I became a senior navigator of several anti-submarine helicopter squadrons in the British Navy. And after that, I got promoted to commander in 1978 and found myself in the Ministry of Defence looking after an admiral who was responsible for Britain's nuclear weapon policy in the Navy, in Polaris submarines. But also, I was there when the decision was taken by Mrs. Thatcher to replace the Polaris submarine force with Trident. And so I was a fly on the wall and watched all the arguments go to and fro. And then in my final job in the Navy, I found myself as Staff Officer Intelligence to the Commander-in-Chief of the Fleet at the Northwood headquarters in the bunker in Northwest London. And my Admiral, Sir John Fieldhouse, found himself running the Falklands War, which was, of course, an unnecessary war to save Mrs. Thatcher's political career. And we basically did the job for her. And I took voluntary redundancy just before that war because she was wanting to cut the Navy in order to be able to pay for Trident. And I was given it. And so I left at the end of 1982. And I dropped out, basically, and became a Ruth Thatcher in Dorset.
You've touched on it a bit there, and Kate, maybe you might want to contribute to this, but I think we need to just understand a little bit about the links between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. Obviously, in a Trident submarine, nuclear powered and been nuclear weapons equipped. But then, of course, it's not just the submarines. We've also got these nuclear power stations around the country, many of which are coming to the end of their useful life. So, I mean, many people say that without nuclear weapons, these power stations probably wouldn't be there. You might find that the Iranians would disagree with you if you were to say that. But can you just both of you say what you think of the links between the two, if any?
Well, I found myself researching nuclear power big time when I picked up Hilda's torch, effectively, and went to the Hinkley Inquiry in 1989 to 1990. But before that, I had been contacted by a former nuclear scientist, Don Arnott, who lived in Wales, who Hilda went to for science lessons, because what she had discovered was that radioactive waste from these nuclear power plants was not only a byproduct of the nuclear industry, which they didn't know what to do with, but what was used to make nuclear weapons. And so there is an incestuous link between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And you'll find that nearly every country that has built nuclear weapons got nuclear power first, because that provides the raw material, the plutonium or the enriched uranium for the fissile core of nuclear bombs.
Kate?
Yeah, I won't add to that, and I know you can edit this bit, but when you go back to Hilda's murder, I think there are big gaps that need to be in there, including the link with the Falklands War and what she was discovering in terms of...
Well, please fill them right now, yeah.
Well, do you mind if I
no,
do
you
that?
Go for it.
Because I think the reason that we wrote the book was that we sat through a five-week trial where we watched pieces of evidence which we knew about not being put before the jury at all. And after the trial, we got access to all the police papers through Andrew George, actually. We had permission to do that. And I remember reading them and finding out that there was DNA evidence under her fingernails and DNA on semen on her cardigan, which was not from Andrew George, but had not been put before a jury. So we meticulously went through all the papers that we could get access to and carried them back from Britain to New Zealand. And the whole time we were getting harassment as we more people came forward to us to say, there's no way that boy could have done what he did. He was at Besford House on the night of the murder. When we started reading about the witness statements, There were cars going in and out of her house at times when Andrew wouldn't have even been there. There were strange men in long coats there. There was a huge amount of material that was not being looked at by the police. He didn't match the description of the driver at any point, and he still can't drive. And we met his partner. We met people who gave us key evidence, including doctors and others. So it forced us to write the book. I did a lot of research for Rob and then help with the writing, because we felt that the story had to get out there. There is definitely a miscarriage of justice. Both of us have met him in prison. We're absolutely convinced that he did not do it on his own. He was in the house, but he could not have done what they say he did. And even if he did take 40 pounds, he has done his time for aggravated burglary many, many years ago. He should not still be in prison 17 years on. So I think that the book caused a stir in New Zealand to a point where our politicians were very concerned that both of us, as leaders in the international disarmament and peace movement, were being harassed with break-ins to our house, our mail being intercepted, all my UN Secretary General papers were being intercepted. It's absolutely unbelievable that this was happening in New Zealand right from the first letters we wrote to each other. Why is that happening if Andrew George is the right man? Why is it still happening to us? Why are the boxes of books of the new edition coming from Britain here? Every single box is cut open and tires are slashed at different times in Britain or here. They must not like us exposing what we know about Hilda. And Hilda, before she was abducted on that day, she was ringing people in the peace movement in her local peace group, to say, I've got sensitive papers, I need them published, where would I get them published? I'm coming to the meeting tonight, can you bring a stout bag? And she never got to the meeting, she was abducted that day. Now, what was it that she knew that is still so sensitive to the British government? She knew a lot about nuclear power, she knew a lot about nuclear weapons, but because she was a spy, potentially from Bletchley Park, and people have come forward and told us this, what did she know that has still not come out, that is sensitive enough that we still get harassment both here and in Britain?
Sorry, can you just clarify what you said there about Bletchley Park?
Rob can answer this one.
Yes, it was very interesting that when we launched the first edition that you've got of the book in Shrewsbury in 2012, we had a huge public meeting. And if you go to the website, hildamurrell.org, you will see a link to the film, because we had that meeting filmed. And it was standing room only. And after the meeting, a woman in the front row, an old woman, came forward to me who was nervous and took me outside in the dark and said, basically, I want you to know that Hilda was a supervisor of a team of young women working on code breaking at Bletchley Park, the famous Enigma code in World War II. She was a top spy in World War II. And so this thickened the plot considerably for us, because it meant that she was an insider. She was one of them. And so
this wasn't known about in your family at all, Rob, no?
No. Mind you, if you ask any members of the family of those whose grannies were at Bletchley Park, they'll all say the same. It was such a tight secret, although it was declassified in 2008, and that's when the fun started, when lots of old ladies came forward saying, I can now tell you, that I was headhunted as a smart young woman who could do crosswords in 20 minutes and was a linguist. And Hilda was certainly one of them, but she was more than that. She was in her 30s by then. And she also was director of Family Rose Nursery. She had tremendous cover job. She was single, unattached, Cambridge graduate, extremely smart, and she had very good contacts.
And following up on the contacts, I've done a lot of research since people have come forward to us about bletching. That's not the only example. But in this book, the latest version, we have a whole chapter with information of people about coming forward. But at Bletchley, when I looked at the names of her friends and Googled a lot of them and read their obituaries, many of them were in SOE. They said they worked at Bletchley, or it was in their obituaries. And of course, she used to go and stay with them in these aristocratic homes all around the country and even in France. And of course, she would have had contacts, and she would know how to hide information, to be careful. She was incredibly well researched in what she wrote, and she would have been respected by a lot of those people who had been at Bletchley and who, if they had information that they knew was sensitive, they would trust someone like Hilda to go public on it. And she was definitely trying to do that. And she was also recording in her diaries, or with friends, the harassment she was receiving, not just with writing the paper she was about to give, but also she was getting break-ins to her house, mail open, same sort of stuff that we get now.
Well, I mean, you might even say back in the 1980s, she was a sort of retiree from the deep state in Britain. That's the sort of term they might use today. But anyway, on the subject of what she was planning to present to the inquiry, why was she so concerned about nuclear power? I think you mentioned the idea of the waste, but what is it specifically that she was? I mean, it sounds to me as if she may have had some kind of bombshell to bring to that inquiry, which may have swung the decision against the Sizewell nuclear power station. So why was she so concerned about it? What was her main concern?
Well, Hilda Ott, she retired in 1970. She was always a pioneer environmentalist. And she saw nuclear power as a serious threat to basically not just the British Isles, but to the landscape, to environment, and that the real poison of all the nuclear industry was radioactive waste. And that when she started researching it, she found that the nuclear industry hadn't even tried to find a way to dispose of nuclear waste. They still haven't. They're still struggling to find willing, bribable communities in UK to do a deep geological disposal, as they call it, in old mine shafts of this ghastly stuff, which is still up in Sellafield in hot, highly radioactive steel tanks that basically are there forever, that have to be kept cool. The whole thing is an utter nightmare, and they have no clue what to do with it, but they don't care. They're going to go on and build more. So this is what she basically homed in on, and she had drafted a very strident critique, which she involved me in. I knew she was writing it, and when after her murder, the police found the draft, and I got a copy of it from them, and I then had found that this retired nuclear scientist, Don Arnott, who she'd been going to, was equally concerned and came to me and said he wanted to help. And so basically what we did was we polished up her critique, and then I applied to present it on her behalf at the Sizewell inquiry. And I did that in September 1984. But after that, we had the first journalists who started to really pursue the nuclear angle about Hilda's work, and starting probably with Judith Cook. And Judith Cook was a famous anti-nuclear journalist who wrote the first book about the case, Who Killed Hilda Murrell, published in June 1985, after a whistleblower called Lawrence Otter, who Hilda had tried to leave her papers with, came forward to her. In fact, he'd come to the police, he'd gone to the police, been rebuffed, and so he contacted her. And then the other angle was that Don Arnott found, got a copy of the official US report into the Three Mile Island accident that had happened in Pennsylvania in 1979, which was of an American pressurized water reactor, which was the same design as the one that was being built at Sizewell or being planned. And he went through that report, and he was a chemistry expert, a pioneer chemistry expert from World War II days. He was headhunted for the nuclear industry and then became an anti-nuclear because he didn't like what they were trying to do, first with bombs and then with power. And basically, he discovered that the melting point of the control rods of the American design had the lowest melting point of any material in the core. So if that core overheated, the control rods of the nuclear core would be the first to go, and then you'd have an uncontrolled nuclear runaway and effectively a reactor nuclear explosion. And they were covering it up.
With Hilda, was she also concerned about nuclear weapons? Did she do research on that and speak about that?
Yep, she was well aware that of the link between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And anyway, she was dead against Mrs. Thatcher's plans for cruise missiles, first of all, to be brought into the country, the Greenham Common. And she supported the Greenham women. And basically, she saw the whole of that program as being a disaster. And she joined European Nuclear Disarmament. She didn't join CND because she realized that it had been smeared heavily by the media and by the government. But European Nuclear Disarmament, which was run by an intellectual, anti-nuclear intellectual called Edward Thompson, she felt was a safer area, and so she actually supported him.
Okay, and what other environmental peace and nuclear groups was she part of?
Just to give you a selection, she basically was a member of Friends of the Earth, Town and Country Planning Association, Council for the Protection of Rural England. She even joined Tories Against Cruise and Trident at one point, which was a wonderful movement. END, of course, European Nuclear Disarmament. She was in the Shrewsbury Peace Group, the Shropshire Peace Alliance, the United Nations Association, Shropshire Wildlife Trust, Federation of University Women, Shrewsbury Civic Society, and the National Trust.
Wow. Certainly she, I mean, the idea of her being a rose grower, I don't know how she found time to grow roses whilst being members of all those organisations.
To answer your question quickly, Tony, she didn't get into that lot of campaigning and support until after she retired.
But she was still in the environmental group. She was way out in front in terms of organic food and trying to grow plants organically. Way Soil Association, going way back, you asked about environmental. So part of her nursery work was to certainly treat the planet carefully, and she used naturopathy and other things for her health. So she was way out in front.
What made her such an effective campaigner?
Right. Well, first of all, she had a formidable intellect, but she could also communicate very strongly as well. She wrote well. She was a fearless speaker. She had enormous self-confidence. And, of course, she was a classic blue stocking from the 1920s in Cambridge. And they were a very high-caliber network, and they were a network of women in UK, the first ones really to be fully liberated, if you like, by their... being allowed to join, you know, the ivory towers of the top universities, and they made very good use of it. So she came back from that and was effectively headhunted by her father, who was sick running the Family Rose Nursery. And instead of perhaps going on to being an academic, he asked that she take over as director of the nursery, which meant she had to get into business. And she took to it like a duck to water and became the first woman director of a rose nursery in Britain, much to the fury of the National Rose Society, which was all male.
It's fascinating. I think also, of course, we have to remember the history of the whole, you know, nuclear industry, if you want, from World War II. The first, it was actually the Germans that first split the atom before the war. And then it was in, apparently, well, we're never entirely sure exactly what happened, but apparently in Birmingham in 1940, Frisch and Piles put together the first design for a potential nuclear bomb. Now, obviously, this was a major prize in World War II that the Nazis were after too. Then the decision was made to ship the development of the nuclear bomb over to the United States because the British didn't really have the resources to develop it in the way that the Americans did with something called the Quebec Agreement. And so I do wonder whether Hilda was sort of tied in with many people in the UK that were concerned about the, you know, the actual decision to use nuclear weapons at the end of the Second World War in the Pacific on Japan, because there were a lot of doubts about whether that was actually necessary to do that or not. You know, maybe a demonstration could have been used to force the Japanese to surrender. So there were still, in the 1980s, many doubts around about the whether these weapons were really necessary in the world, and whether it was possible to sort of, you know, as you are still campaigning to do, to actually make them illegal and to stop their use because they're so indiscriminate. So I wonder if it might have been, Rob, her network of people who were, you know, she's very, very well connected in with an establishment which was basically set its face against this very powerful new nuclear power industry.
Yes, and of course the fact that she was involved with Bletchley Park meant that she got on the inside track of a lot of that world, and so she would have been, if you like, had access and security clearance almost to all the earliest developments probably to do with nuclear weapons. Although no women were involved in the nuclear weapon industry. And, of course, it is another fact that that it is now recorded that despite the fact that dear Marie Curie in France first discovered radioactivity along with dear old Rutherford down here in New Zealand, it was an all-male preserve. Because, of course, what they were doing was they were playing with the building blocks of the universe. They were playing God. And that's always been, I believe, a very dangerous game to play for mankind. And I use the word mankind very specifically.
It's almost like this kind of philosopher's stone, isn't it? You know, the idea that the occultists are going for almost like the one thing that they really mustn't touch. It's almost like a drug, this whole technology. And of course, there's a tremendous amount of money being spent on it. I mean, it's almost sucked in so much cash. We're looking now in the UK at the building of new nuclear power stations. And I just wonder if you could say something about what you make of the latest generation. We here in Somerset have been dealing with spiraling costs of the Hinkley C, which is now under construction. And in a conversation I had with the nuclear engineer John Large before he died, he was convinced that it would never actually finally be built and be switched on because of all of the problems with this design. And you know, he was borne out actually last year when the Chinese Taishan reactor, which is the same design as Hinkley C, just a year after it was switched on, had to be switched off for a year because it wasn't working properly. So there is a kind of white elephant element to this. But I wonder, what do you make of this latest iteration of I think it's called the EPR, the new generation of nuclear power stations? Because the thing that amazes me almost more than anything else about this is that the environmental, certain parts, should we say, of the environmental movement seem to have embraced it as so carbon neutral.
Yes, well, of course, the propaganda battle rages on about nuclear power's role in, solving the climate crisis. But it's a nonsense because it's too expensive. It takes far too long. By the time Hinkley C was ever up and running, we'd all be fried. But all the alternative is, of course, that the renewables will have solved the problem. And so it is an absolute irrelevance, and it's a terrible conceit, basically. But the nuclear industry has never been short of public relations. They have always had this dream that they were going to prevail one day and they would be needed, bless them. And so this is their latest attempt. And Hinkley Point C, they've been trying ever since Sizewell was built to get a second PWR up and running. And Hinkley is the latest effort. And I found myself caught up in opposing Hinkley C back in 1989 to 1990. And I learned a lot more about the nuclear industry then.
Rob, one of your papers was, I think you delivered to one of the inquiries, was called "Can Democracy Survive with Nuclear Power?" It's like what you're saying is that the two are incompatible. And I wonder, could you just explain that? Because certainly we've been living with nuclear power and apparently democracy for the last 80 years or so.
Yes. Well, of course, the first thing is that no way could you really call the United Kingdom a democracy. It is an oligarchy. It is I better not go on about that, but basically we need to actually get things straight here. It's an elective dictatorship. And so this is the sort of world that nuclear power can thrive in, because, of course, the only way nuclear power is going to get its way is through secrecy. And so, and basically, the link with nuclear weapons helps the nuclear industry basically cover up its tracks. And any faults that it may have discovered or maybe in the designs are always suppressed. And this is basically what I set out to do at the Hinkley Inquiry, was to expose some of those.
Can you just explain what the main danger is? Because most people, I don't think, understand, I included, with a nuclear power station, you can have a meltdown, but surely this is if the core gets so hot, it all melts and it starts to sort of go through the bottom of the reactor. That isn't really so dangerous, is it, as a nuclear bomb? I mean, it's just likely to sit there and someone's got to pay to deal with it. But I mean, it's, for example, like Fukushima. This is what's happened there, and it's being dealt with. It's extremely expensive. It's very irritating, but it's nowhere near as dangerous as some of the campaigners are saying. It's not like a nuclear bomb going off, is it?
It's in the water.
Well, basically, Fukushima was a good example of what happens when you have an earthquake, which and a tsunami, which messes up the cooling water system for pressurized, well, in fact, it was a boiling water reactor there, but that is the sort of earlier version, which actually is much safer than a pressurized water reactor because it doesn't operate at such high pressure. The problem with a pressurized water reactor is that it's been extrapolated from a nuclear submarine's propulsion system. And one of the things that you need to understand about nuclear submarine propulsion is that it is so powerful, that nuclear power plant, that it is actually idling when that submarine is at full speed. And that is the reality of nuclear power. And secondly, you can never turn nuclear power off. You can put in the control rods and it holds it down. But this is a continuing reaction which has to be constantly cooled. and with a pressurized water reactor, which is like the Sizewell design and the one that Hinckley is trying to replicate, it's basically an exercise in technological brinkmanship. Everything is under massive pressure. And I've tried to, what I did do was, with Don Arnott's help, we actually testified at the Hinckley inquiry, in which he really spelt out exactly how, on the edge of catastrophe, pressurized water reactors run at. And but he only had one aspect which he could talk about because he was a chemist, which was he found about the low melting point of the control rods, which incidentally Hinckley Point C is going to have exactly the same problem. But what he then said was, but there are far more problems, and anyway, he wasn't qualified to be able to testify properly. He said, you need a nuclear engineer from America who basically has experience of pressurized water reactors. And so, and he said, the only guy who has actually broken out from the nuclear industry and opposed that is a former Navy nuclear engineer called Dr. Richard Webb, and you need to get him and come and testify. And I did.
Well, the importance of recognizing that all of the states that have got nuclear weapons, that openly have them, have got it from the waste of nuclear power plants. There is no safe way of storing the waste, and countries like Japan and others are stockpiling plutonium and are able to make nuclear weapons at any point. And to, I would argue too that the accident at Sellafield and at Fukushima, the what went into the water and but certainly into the atmosphere at both of those places was recorded all over the world. I mean, even from Chernobyl, it was found here in terms of radioactivity. But with Sellafield, what you had with at Windscale, what it was called beforehand, is that the radioactive cloud went over to the east coast of Ireland, and there were many cases of deformed children born there. And we know in the Pacific what's happened with the Pacific Islands, where there was nuclear testing, so bombs were used, different from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but the radioactivity in our water system, but in the land, is still there, for, and it will be there forever and ever, and many children, babies being born deformed. This was an issue that Hilda also was concerned about and helped get someone like Rosalie Bertel over to the hearing at Sellafield. To speak about it. So, you know, I think there are so many insidious links in terms of nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And to say that it's carbon neutral, it's not. And we know that because there's still a huge amount of infrastructure that needs to be built. And who funds it? There is often government subsidy for it, where we haven't been getting the subsidies for all the alternatives in the past. So many questions still need to be asked about nuclear power. And you asked about New Zealand. We actually have it as policy linked with the non-proliferation treaty that we have chosen not to ever get nuclear power, even though there is uranium in New Zealand.
Well, so will you dig the uranium out and sell it to someone who will make
No, coal? We will not do what Australia does with the French. So.
I must ask you, Kate, particularly, I mean, you can't reinvent this stuff. Aren't you really banging your hands against a brick wall, saying that these nuclear bombs have got to go? Because, you know, for the powerful in the world, this is the one thing that they like to have behind their back. When they're at negotiations, to threaten other countries in order to win in those negotiations, isn't it?
Yes, but we've had negotiations to get a treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. We succeeded in getting that in 2017. The majority of states want a treaty to ban them. We've got it. It's been ratified because there's been enough states. Sure, there are the outlaws, including all the big states that have nuclear weapons who have not changed, but it's only going to be public opinion that will change that, and also pressure from the other states and also the law. I think having a legal treaty now is huge. It took a long time to get those naughty states like Britain and others to come on board on cluster munitions and landmines, but they did in the end. And and on chemical and biological weapons, you have to have the treaties to make that happen. And that's why the work at the UN is so important on pulling those treaties together.
Yes, but you know as well as I do that there's been a conflict in the Middle East which has been bubbling away ever since the Second World War. And now, of course, we know that the Israelis have got nuclear weapons. There's a nuclear weapons element to that conflict, which doesn't look like it's going away anytime soon, does it?
No, and it's supported by the Americans, which is tragic and terrible. But and they haven't signed on to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. There are a lot of as we call them, outlaws in the peace movement. But again, there are citizen movements in all those places, including parliamentarians who are speaking out in their own cabinets and using the treaty on prohibition of nukes as pressure points to say you've got to come on and sign for this. It takes a long time. It took us for a long time to get the P5, the permanent five, to sign on to the South Pacific nuclear weapon-free zone and all the other nuclear weapon-free zones that we've got around the world. And it does take time, but I believe it will happen. And it's the only way you can do it is through treaties.
Yeah, and at least there is one element that these weapons, even some military people see as unusable simply because of the consequences of using them. Can we finish with the sort of, in a way, it's a bit of an open wound with Hilda's story, that is to say, Andrew George. Is there anything, do you think, that we can do, Rob, with the
Inquiry.
yeah,
Yes.
what is going on with him? Because obviously there is, I mean, we've even seen a news story recently I was reading that one of his cellmates has said that he was no longer, sorry, one of his cellmates has said that he was not alone, that he had accomplices, because he's been chatting about this to them in their cells. And this is a quite obvious, the people that committed this murder are still at large if they're not dead already.
Now, Andrew George is going to be kept in jail, we believe, forever. This is the British gulag, because he was a key witness to this state crime. And he knows stuff which they feel that would really ruin their day if he was released. And in fact, he probably would not survive very long if he was released. He's now institutionalized. And I think probably he's happier and quite philosophical about it that he's in the safest place at the moment, because he had this terrible secret about what the British deep state really did about my aunt. And so he that is one problem. But the other aspect, of course, is that it would blow open the whole edifice of a nuclear secrecy and double dealing and viciousness of the nuclear state.
But I believe we need someone to come forward who has information from the outside. And there are people, they have tried to come forward to us, they have tried to get information to us. This blog may help, and I think films about Hilda may help get people with a conscience to speak out, because there are people definitely who know.
But I mean, Andrew is a key witness. I mean, he almost certainly, knows the names of, et cetera, the people that did this, no?
He won't know the
He
names.
won't know the names, but he will have seen that there were other people involved, and it was far more complicated and sinister than the police have made up.
Well, we'll certainly be following it, and I think you're absolutely right. It was one of the things I noticed was the BBC drama series The Edge of Darkness came out round about the same time all this was happening, didn't it? Just the year before Chernobyl. How about that? In 1985, which, if anyone hasn't seen it, I suggest you sit down and remember what the BBC used to produce back in the day before it became so much more controlled by the establishment. Finally, then, Rob and Kate, could you just say whereabouts online or elsewhere, and with books and things like that, if people want to follow up, they can read about this and keep an eye on what's happening with the nuclear debate and particularly with Hilda's case still.
Right. Well, if there is a website called basically very simple, hildamurrell.org. We have there all the various sources, the films, the books. I think that is a really good start. And maybe you'd like to just follow through on that.
Yes, but also our Disarmament and Security Centre website's got a lot of information on it. It's just disarmsecure.org, and you'll find copies of Rob's books, Debunking Nuclear Deterrence and Security Without Nuclear Deterrence, are on that website. And the last one is the Stop Hinkley website, where Rob's draft chapter on what he did in terms of opposing Hinkley many years ago is up there as well and featured. And that is stophinkley.org.
Well, stop. The Hinkley Power Station is the biggest white elephant I've ever seen in my life. It is unbelievable. And in fact, chatting to the nuclear scientist Chris Busby, who's done a lot of work
Ah, yes.
into the low-level radiation campaign, into the leukemia clusters around these nuclear power stations, he's convinced that it's just a boondoggle, basically, where the people who are constructing it are going to make a fortune. But actually, when it comes to it, the thing probably won't even work. But anyway, from Bristol in England to Christchurch in New Zealand, Kate and Rob, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Tony.
Bye.